Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we're doing our February wrap-up podcast. And so we're bringing in the big guns. We're talking about the man, the myth, the legend, my dad. Welcome back to the show, Dad.
Oh, when you said big guns, I thought you were talking about your arms.
Oh, hey-o. We'll be here all day. Yeah. Yes, my dad is on the phone. We had a little difficulty getting my dad to be able to use a phone, but he got it figured out now, and we are ready to go. So thank you, Dad, for being with us again. This is your third podcast, am I right?
That is correct.
So people know who you are. They know my dad. I reference you quite often in the show. But if they don't know who my dad is, you'll notice on this phone call there is one person who is a follower of Jesus and one who is a follower of Sigmund Freud. That would be you, because you're a psychologist, and so that's going to be kind of your angle you come from.
Well, psychology, yes. I'm not as much Freud as I am cognitive behavioral, but I do have an appreciation for a psychodynamic perspective.
That's all the same to me. Isn't okay. Dr. Phil, he's one of your kind, right?
He's called a entertainer.
Okay, but he's cognitive behavioral.
He does use a lot of cognitive and behavioral as well as some things that are not empirically based.
Okay.
So, and that's why he surrendered his license.
Oh, okay. How many times during your counseling sessions do you ever say, and I hate to break it to you, but you are not the father?
I don't think I've ever had to do that.
Okay, I didn't know. I don't know if Freud did that, but I thought Dr. Phil did. But we're going to do some wrap up. People don't know, we had Pete Rollins, Jamie Wright, Richard Beck, Zach Lind, and AJ Swoboda as our guests for the month of February. And Dad, you checked those out. You enjoyed them, didn't you?
I absolutely did. And I hope everybody else got to hear them all, because they were definitely worth the time.
Yeah. So let's just go in order. How about that?
Well, that would be fine, but as you know from your position within the family, we always put you first. So I want to ask you a question.
Oh, well, I'm the youngest child, so I don't think I'm actually the first. But what questions do you have, Dad?
Well, multiple. I know I'm only implying one. I don't want to spend that much time talking to you.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, no. Hey, no, you have spoken to a lot of people and who have shared some incredibly important issues and ideas. And I'd like for you to just address what that's like for you.
Well, it's still surreal to me to think of, you know, the people I get to talk to, and it's just crazy to think about how this whole podcast has come about and you know, what it looks like now and the people I get to talk to next month. And it's pretty surreal to me, but I think as I'm trying to figure out like what's really behind this, is like what's really my driving motivation, I think for me, like the big deal is trying to find people who articulate a faith in a way that makes sense to me. I think there's a lot of people out there who talk about Jesus, and as a Jesus person, I'm very passionate about how Jesus is communicated and the message of Jesus and Christianity. And there seems to be like kind of reoccurring themes in the people that I have. Do you see that, Dad? Like people seem to kind of touch on something. Yeah, definitely. And so I think one of the big things for me is that there are people who have a critical faith. And I don't mean that in like the pessimistic, cynical way, but people who are asking hard questions and don't have a fear of kind of going places that others maybe have fear of going. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a developmental process. And I think we always want to be considerate of those that are not able or willing or ready to go to some of those harder kind of questions. Mm-hmm. And so having a special program for it, that makes sense, that there are some people that may choose not to listen in because they're not quite ready to do that. On the other hand, to have a forum for people that have put a lot of their life energy into asking the tough questions, seeking how that should play out in their life, as well as being an encouragement to others, I think that's fantastic. Yeah. So I think the program, the show is really doing a great service.
Well, thanks. And I think that's a good point, that what I do on Sunday morning as a pastor doesn't look exactly like what the podcast is. And this is a conversation that not everyone has to get to. It's a conversation not everyone has to go through to, you know, fulfill their spiritual journey that they're on. But there are definitely people who are asking these questions, and there needs to be a venue for them to engage with these ideas without having to make everyone be prescribed this as the only way to gain spiritual maturity or to be a disciple of Jesus.
Right, right. Well, let me follow up with one other question, and then I'll let you take the lead here. But the other part of that question is not only what is it like talking to those people, but being bombarded by all of these issues and ideas. And I don't want to engender a negative image in your mind, but, for example, in graduate school, you had many ideas that just flooded you, mm-hmm. and there's not time for you to act on them. And so, anyway, I'm just wondering, what is this like for you to be bombarded by all these issues and ideas?
Yeah, well, I think there are a lot of pastor friends of mine who read as much as I do, if not more. And so I don't think I'm the only one really doing this. I have friends who probably read you know, more books every week than I'm doing. And so they're, you know, inundated with the ideas just like I am. But I think what I learned in the grad school experience, and I include a couple years after grad school, is that you have to be able to process and conceptualize ideas and then be able to communicate that after you've already internalized it and lived it out. And so there's like the basic, you know, eating catfish metaphor that, you know, you need to learn how to eat the meat and spit out the bones. And that seems to be something that becomes a whole lot easier after you've had to do that for a while. And so a lot of these books are books that I would be reading anyway, but I wouldn't have the opportunity to sit down and pick the brains of the author and to hear what she or he is really thinking when they wrote that stuff. And so in some ways, it's easier for me to kind of go to the next step of having internalized the information and try to live it out and then, you know, articulate it as a pastor or just as a human being trying to articulate faith to the people around me. It's easier once I've wrestle with the idea, engage with the author, and then kind of like that next step is, it seems like I'm already there, or I'm closer to being there.
Yeah, yeah, gotcha. What are some of the issues or topics that stand out the most that have happened, not necessarily just over this last month, but since you've been doing podcasts?
What are the things that seems to always pop up in at least one book every month or two, if not more than that, is the idea of the dark night of the soul, which comes from John of the Cross, and it's the idea of the divine being absent and the feeling like that God isn't with you. And you see this in books from Barbara Brown Taylor references it, Jonathan Merritt talks about it, Richard Rohr is going to talk about it. I mean, there's a John Ortberg, I think, talked about it. A ton of people have referenced it. And I'm trying to figure out, like, what makes that idea, like, so interesting today? Like, why? And I would have to assume that part of the reason is because that's part of the normal human experience with the divine, right? Does it make sense? Like, that's just a normal thing. It's happened throughout history. You have people like Mother Teresa who experienced it and other spiritual greats. And so part of it is like, that it would be normative. Don't you think, Dad? Like, that's part of the normal
stuff. Yeah, yeah. No, I think it is. I think it's normal, and I think it's something about the zeitgeist that we're in a time right now where we can openly talk about that and not be discouraging.
I would also say that it's part of a reaction to what is often articulated about faith. And like I was saying before, what I really like about some of these authors, and I was talking to someone not too long ago about Barbara Brown Taylor and what I love so much about her. It's not that as much that she has given me ideas that I never conceptualized before, as much as it is her putting into words and articulating things which previously I was unable to express. And so what I love about, like, Barbara Brown Taylor is that she's able to articulate a faith that names that dark night of the soul as normative, as part of what it means to be a Jesus follower, but does it in the context of saying, It's not because you don't pray enough. It's not because you don't have enough faith. It's because this is part of the spiritual journey. And I think that goes back to this critical versus kind of uncritical faith, where you have people who in some ways just like check off their brain and act like their opinion on certain things is the only possible option, as though Christians throughout history haven't disagreed and wrestled with some of these hard issues. But like the megachurch pastor gets up there and says a very, problematic statement, as though there is no need for nuance or subtlety, but just, this is it. We're the right one. And instead, like, there's this undercurrent of spirituality, which is bubbling up. And that's been there all along, of course, that people say, wait a minute, it's not this black and white. It's not this simple yes or no, but there's nuance and there's complexity. And we're going to try to make sense of all of it, not just the stuff that makes sense and seems easy for us.
So if the dark night of the soul is part of our human experience, what do you think are some of the areas of that darkness that need to be developed even more?
Well, obviously part of it is that God isn't mad at you because it seems as though God isn't there. Like, first and foremost, it doesn't mean God is against you, and that needs to be undone. There is a popular remake of the old song, My Hope Is Built. You remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a new version of it, and they change the lyric that says, when darkness hides your lovely face. And the new version says, when darkness seems to hide your face. They're wanting to say, wait a minute, this isn't normal. It's only because you don't have faith, or you're not looking right, or you haven't prayed enough. And there needs to be a statement that says, no, this is part of the spiritual journey, and it's not because God hates you. It's not because you've done something wrong. This is something that people like Mother Teresa have experienced, and you're probably going to experience it too.
So you focused on one of the ideas that seems to be reoccurring among your presenters, this darkness of the night. Tell me another concept or idea that you think stands out.
Well, I would say that the opposition of faith and science as being something that needs to be torn down keeps on showing up. The idea that faith and science are not enemies, that you can have a faith that makes sense of historical data, of critical thinking, of literary criticism of the Bible, of, you know, harder questions that don't necessitate the absence of faith and don't require people to run away from church, but there is a way that you can bring all this together. And that's kind of this holistic spirituality, which I think is so compelling that Rohr brings and some of these other great spiritual thinkers have.
Mm-hmm. So you've touched on two things. Are there any other things that you would like to say really stand out from your conversations with your presenters?
Dad, you're making me dig pretty deep here. You got two answers.
Okay.
Now you got three.
That's why I said, do you have any others? I was giving you a way, if you had something else, you could go for it.
Now that you mention it, though, I think I think the idea of, like, the second naivete, there's a theologian named Ricoeur who talked about, there's like a simplistic way, and then once you experience life, you experience the disorientation of the Psalms. I think that's Brueggemann's language.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got to come back and find a reorientation. And so I think that's kind of the spiritual journey that a lot of people go on, where, and I think Rollins touched on this, you know, at first you have this simplistic faith, and then you get these hard questions, and doubt starts to bubble up, and these things that bother you don't ever go away. And then you're faced with a choice. Do you give up? Do you walk away from faith? Or do you find a faith that's more comprehensive, that deals with the complexity, but then you can come out on the other side and have, I think this is Bell's language, you have a simplicity, you have complexity, and then there is simplicity on the other side of complexity. You have a faith that I'm going to understand what's going on in the text. I'm going to understand that there is a lot of nuance and subtlety, and that there is theological disagreement about things, but I can still have a childlike faith, even though I'm willing to ask some of these hard questions. And I think that's kind of like this goal that we all need to get to. Because you have like this simplistic kind of faith that buries its head in the sand and doesn't deal with the hard questions. And then you have a type of faith that just stays in the hard questions and never kind of metabolizes it. But then on the other side of that, there is a way. And there's a third way out there. And I think that's what I hope my listeners get to. And that's one of the reasons why I want this podcast to get out there, so that people can see there is a way that's beyond simplicity. There's a way that's beyond cynicism. There is another option.
Wow, that's very powerful in itself. What are you hoping for your listeners? So here they are listening to your podcast. What do you hope they walk away with?
I guess that hope really is that they see another way. Like there is something beyond cynicism, there's something beyond simplicity. And I've had this conversation with multiple people who got to the cynicism. And they experience hard questions, and some just kind of walk away. Some say, well, you know what, I don't care, I'm just going to check out. Some are just going to say, well, this is what I have to do. I'm going to have to always go to church because that's the socially appropriate thing for, you know, my family or whoever. But they stop engaging with it. And what I would hope that people get from this is there is a way to engage on the other side. There's a way to engage on the other side of the questions. And that's what is so compelling about Rollins' work, is that he's willing to ask those hard questions. And that's what I think makes people gravitate to him. He said something about, you know, like attracts like. And people sense in him that he's asked these questions and he's gone there. And for people who are asking those questions, I hope that this can be a vehicle for them to be connected to people who are asking similar questions, and that they can learn to... that they aren't alone in this, like we're talking about the importance of community, and that there is there's a way to get through it, and that doesn't have to be the end of your story right there.
Once you get beyond that cynicism and you start putting your stake down, and by that you kind of simplify. There's a lot of issues that you recognize. You just can't answer all those questions, so you start saying, here are the basic things, and anything beyond that, I'm just going to let go. And now your life truly gets focused on that. Does that mean you're not human anymore and you may not question it again? No, but going through those tough times, I think the voice of Job is more likely to come out that even if he slay me, I will hope in him. Yeah. And, you know, even if I perceive, that's the way I would word that, even if I perceive that God is trying to slay me, I think I'm going to hope in him.
Yeah, that's good. It seems like the more that you get through kind of that second phase and get to the third phase, you hold on to less things. And so there's a lot of like these secondary things that you don't have to like know the answer to. Like some people get really hung up over, did Jonah really happen? Did it not happen? And it doesn't like really shake my faith one way or the other. And people get hung up over, okay, the Gospels, they obviously have a different account. And there's really no way you can line those four different stories up into one chronological event. There's just no way you can do that and get Jesus' teaching to all line up. And some people go, well, that's really hard for me to process that and continue to have faith in God. And what I would say is like, that doesn't really bother me. Like if it happened or didn't happen that exact way, it doesn't really affect my faith one way or the other. And like the more I wrestle through these things, the less I hold to those things as tightly. But the one thing it always goes down to is death, burial, resurrection. Like that is the centerpiece. And that is what I hold on to with a death grip. But everything else, I just kind of hold loosely to it. And I feel like that's like, I think that's, you know, 1 Corinthians 15, honestly, you know, like Paul says, what I pass on to you, or what I received, I pass on to you is of first importance. Like Christ Jesus, Christ Jesus died, was buried, was resurrected, you know, according to scripture. And that's like that's really helpful to stop holding on to everything with that same level of conviction, but hold on to the one thing that matters.
Right. So stand firm, continue in the work of the Lord, for you know that nothing you do in the Lord is in vain.
Look at you, Dad, quoting the Bible.
Man.
I'm so impressed. I feel like I should quote the DSM-4 to even this out so you'd be proud of me.
But we're in the five now, so.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the podcasts now. One of your favorite guests of all time that I've had on the podcast is Pete Rollins, and I told him that. And I'm sure you're excited to see him back on the podcast.
Absolutely. Oh, not only have I listened to him on the podcast, but I listened to him on, what's the guy's name, Pete from California?
Pete Holmes?
Pete Holmes,
How did you find Pete Holmes' podcast with Pete Rollins on it?
You know me and technology. I am so illiterate that I stumbled around and just happened to download a few apps that I thought, well, at some point I might be interested in listening to this. And would you believe it? He popped up.
You found it all by yourself. That's really impressive. Now, for people who don't know, Pete Holmes is a comedian. He was the late night guy after Conan on TBS for a while, and that show got canceled. But he's got a very popular podcast that Pete Rollins was on a few months ago before he was on the podcast again a second time for this one. So what did you think of Pete Holmes' podcast with Rollins?
Well, of course, I have a bias. The standard's already been set, so anything's going to fall short of that. But Pete did a great job. Boy, but Peter, man, he put Pete on his thumbs quite often. That he just didn't know what to say. He would even come out and say, "Well, I don't even know what to say to that," and he would laugh. And
yeah.
And of course, he's into humor, but his laughing was, "I don't know what to say."
To
you. He was just blowing him away.
No,
but he did a great job of asking great questions to give Peter a chance to really express his views.
Yeah, I thought my first interview with Pete Rollins was the hardest interview I've ever done. It was just a very difficult time for me keeping up with what Rollins was. I think the second one went a whole lot better because I have a little bit more familiarity with Pete as a person now, and I know his work a little better. But to see Pete Holmes, a comedian, someone who's, you know, definitely playing a different game, to keep up with Rollins, I mean, that's... It's not easy, but I think he did an impressive job with it. So when Rollins was on the podcast, he brought up Freud. He brought up obviously some psychological vernacular stuff that you would have enjoyed. He seems to always kind of go back to the idea that, you know, God doesn't exist to make you happy and whole, but God exists to give you the freedom from the pursuit of happiness. As a psychologist, how do you understand that? Do you see that as being like a central part of what, you know, good therapy and counseling is doing as well?
Well, I think one of the main things about therapy is about being honest, being able to get beyond your own defense mechanisms, to look at what you think and believe. And we have so many things that cause us to have defense mechanisms. It's not just a psychodynamic process, but our society labels a number of things as being socially appropriate to talk about as well as taboos, and consequently it becomes really difficult for us to delve deeply into ourselves.
Mm-hmm. He was talking about the existential angle. He referenced another comedian, a guy named Louis C.K., about how he did a 20-minute rant on death and our immortality, and he talked about how much he really appreciated the comedian going into that because that's kind of his angle. In your world, how much do you find that being something that people really need to do? I think even Beck referred back to you in the podcast that he did about the importance of existential psychology drawing us back to the day by day by reminding us of our immortality.
Well, that's a really big question. There's a lot of different directions to go with that. But Peter, he's got to be coming from an existential perspective as a trained philosopher. And so consequently, he's talking about the philosophy in terms of what it means to exist as being a human being. And death is one of those issues that is really hard for us to be honest about. And so, yeah, I see why Peter likes comedians, because basically what he was saying, well, comedians have the ability to tell the truth and basically do it in a way that oftentimes would not be acceptable in other social situations.
Have you seen that practically where you needed to remind someone of their own mortality to help them function better in the present?
Yeah. And unfortunately, well, again, let me give you a simple example that a person is in a low spot in their life. I'm thinking of a person who's married. I'm thinking of a person who is evaluating their values. A person that has children is trying to figure out what do I do with my children? Do I put myself first? Which, by the way, in an individualistic society like the United States, oftentimes the verbiage is the individual is even more important than the marriage. So if the individual is not happy, then it's okay to step outside of it.
Yeah.
But let me go back to your question. So how does death play into that? So it's okay. Well, let's talk about if you were writing your own epitaph as a mother or as a parent or as a spouse, what would you want it to say? And so the understanding that their life has an end to it helps a person then to focus on, wow, so what is the meaning? What do I want to be responsible about? What do I want to be known for in the present?
Yeah. I actually recorded yesterday the first podcast for March, and it's one of my friends who I think he's like 35. He's got three daughters just like me, and he just was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And that's one of the things that he's going to talk about being pressed right in his face as he discusses, you know, what it's like as a, you know, guy in his 30s to be told that, you know, you have stage 4 colon cancer that spread to your lymph nodes and your liver and, you know, trying to process that. And that's definitely one of the first things that that came to his mind. And it's a very powerful show that I think people are going to really enjoy. But let's go back to that exercise, though. If someone's, you know, being a narcissistic person or, you know, living out of their narcissism even more than they should, and they're thinking of making a choice that puts me before the we of our family, when they go through the mental process of thinking about what do I want my life to be remembered for, what do I want my life to have set a precedence of, how does, I guess, so the process of thinking about that helps them in the present act in a better way, right? I mean, that seems to be pretty a basic concept.
As a licensed psychologist, one of the ethics is that I cannot impose my values on my client. So when you say, what can I do to help them have good behavior, part of the question is good according to what?
Okay.
And so if I'm working with a person and I say, okay, let's think about the question of if you're thinking about ending the relationship and you're also thinking about how you would satisfy your individual needs, it's not about my values, and consequently, it's kind of scary, but it's very real, and we're trying to be very honest about, okay, so what do you think about this? And so I am not trying to get that person to, and I'm talking in a general way here, I am not trying to make the decision for the person. I'm trying to help them to identify what they think and believe, not just in the present, but in the future, mm-hmm. how that's going to impact them so that they can make the very best decision they know how.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So what Rollins seems to do so well is that he's willing to kind of pick apart some of the false ways that we have idolized God, and like God is this divine vehicle for us to get, you know, the life that we always wanted. And it seems like now it's never going to be like health and wealth. Like that becomes kind of the character that people point to and say, well, that's at least not what we're doing. And so we push that to the side and say, well, at least we're not offering people a Lexus or, you know, whatever luxury car and, you know, a big house or whatever. We're not offering that, but we have some of these other ways that we continue to do that same thing where we say, you know, if God is in your life, you'll never feel lonely. If God is in your life, you'll always be fulfilled. If God's in your life, you'll always be happy. And if you have enough faith, then you can get rid of all those things, the loneliness, the doubt, the insecurity. And what I love about Rollins is that he's willing to call us on the carpet and say, that's not really what Jesus is offering. And the other side of that, though, is what do you then say that Jesus offers people? And like that becomes a harder question, is because you still need to say, Jesus said, I am the bread of life. Those who come after me will never be hungry and thirsty. Well, what does it mean if you don't understand what Jesus offers as those things? What does it mean for Jesus to offer life and a way that you will never be hungry and thirsty if it's not that parameter? And so there's almost like another side of like, well, how do we get past kind of the abuses of it to really, you know, to really base ourselves in what is really Jesus' offer? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if Peter Rollins was present with us, one of the things that I would say to him, first of all, I would compliment him, and I would say that I'm trying to kind of tie this in with your last speaker, AJ.
Yeah, AJ Svoboda.
Svoboda, yes, thank you. Looking at Easter as three different days, mm-hmm. and I'm gonna try to merge these together just real quickly, and that would be that I think I would compliment Peter and say, you are doing an incredible job of being able to articulate what it's like to be under the cross on Friday. You are speaking to people that are in suffering, in pain. You are speaking to people that have are going through that kind of suffering, as well as I think he's doing a tremendous job to speaking to people that are not in the shadow of the cross. And that's where, obviously, the metaphor breaks down. Everybody is in the shadow of the cross, but there are some people that haven't learned to yet connect to God. And the other thing, I think, Peter, then, in terms of that disillusion, that disorientation that happens on Saturday, where we had all of these hopes and thoughts about who Jesus was going to be, and they're crushed. We don't know where to go. What's going on? And I think that's part of what he is saying is, wait a minute, I thought religion was going to do this for me. And those that are even that continue to think about it, it's, oh, not just the ways that we go about trying to reconnect to God, but these are even expectations we have about God. So these are the people that are really disillusioned. And I think Peter is saying, yeah, you're exactly right. We don't have wholeness and we don't have completeness. And now I'm going to try to answer your question and at the same time encourage Peter. I'd really like to hear him write after this trilogy that he's wrapping up. I'd like to see him talk about what it's like to be part of the resurrection. And I think part of, and I'm not a theologian, so I can't hit the main points in one or two words, but I would say the answer to your question is we do have a hope. And it goes way beyond the disillusionments that we are currently experiencing. And somehow, even though we are being torn apart, literally torn apart outwardly, we are being renewed inwardly. There is a joy that goes beyond what we can understand.
Yeah, and so that's what Svoboda is trying to talk about, I think, with the Friday, the Saturday, and the Sunday experiences, that you have to get all three of those. And if you just stay in one, you're not missing the point, which I thought that was a really good idea. I thought the way that he was articulating that was a really helpful metaphor for us. And his basic premise is that most of us just rush to the Easter experience. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I'm going to say that. What was the last part?
Well, his assessment is that most of us just rush to the Sunday experience. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I do. I think we're all looking for comfort. I think we're all fleeing from pain. I think that's part of what Peter is talking about, is we're looking for that object that is going to give us satisfaction. And it's the thing that's you know, all metaphors break down, and it almost sounds like the metaphor is talking about a one-time shot. And yet, obviously, we go through a variety of different seasons in our life, and the intensity may vary from time to time. And so I think we go through all of those stages, if you will, multiple times through our life.
Is that just based on the circumstances that we're in? It just seems like we're more on a Friday or Saturday or Sunday experience?
Well, I think it's a much more complicated answer than that. I think that if we're going with what Rollins is talking about, is that some people find it really difficult to be that honest and to ask the tough questions. And the people that are asking the tough questions, they may or may not be in Friday. They could be at any one of those days within that metaphor, if you will.
Okay, so what do you think makes it so hard for some people to ask those questions, to make them never really park in Friday or Saturday when they need to be, based on whatever's going on in their life or, you know, whatever is making it seem like it's Friday or Saturday?
Yeah. Well, I think now let me go back to Freud and say, really, he would say anxiety is a conscious experience, but it is caused by either unconscious conflicts that are occurring within the id, or it's coming from moral anxiety from our superego, which is primarily our conscience and our ego ideal. The other part of it is real anxiety, that there are some dangers in the reality that we're living in. So it's any threat. What we want to do is get rid of the anxiety, and to live in that anxiety or / suffering is something that I think is part of our human nature.
Hmm. So then if it's our human nature to get away from that anxiety, why do you think it's important to park in those times of the pain of Friday and the awkwardness of Saturday?
Because it doesn't go away just because we push it down into our unawareness.
Yeah.
It, using Freudian terms, in the unconscious. So, and I think Peter illustrated that quite well several times. He used the example about the person he was talking to who had lost a son. And he asked, basically he was making the point that when the man was pushing that out of his awareness, it didn't go away. He was actually more miserable. But when he brought it into consciousness, he was able to deal with it.
Yep.
And as a psychologist, I really think we can deal with reality better than we can delusions.
Yep.
I think we can deal with reality in Christ no matter what it is. I don't think there's any reality that is going to totally crush us. And it's not because we're strong, but because we're united to Him.
Yeah, that's good. Did you hear AJ's line? He said that joy is metabolized pain.
Yeah, I did.
You liked it?
Oh, I liked it. I know a little bit about the body metabolizing different things. So it becomes part of you in that sense. The pain becomes part of you. And I think ultimately, having worked with, now if you ask me how many patients I've worked with, I'm going to go with AJ and say, how many times has he read the book of Job? What was it, 102?
102, exactly. It was 102.
Yeah, I don't know how many it was, but I've seen the book of Job play out in a lot of people, per se, and the people that are able to make the pain part of their story are the people that are able to make the adjustments.
Yep.
And continue on. The people that are saying, no, this hurts too much for me to look at it and to deal with it, are the ones that are still under its influence.
Yeah, so his line about joy is metabolized pain made a whole lot of sense to me, and it made me wonder if you could make a difference or set apart joy from happiness, that happiness is like covering over the actual pain that exists and never dealing with it. And so happiness is almost like a distraction, but joy comes from doing the hard work of dealing with the pain, of naming it for what it is and accepting what your life actually is compared to glossing it over and trying to get happiness.
I like that. I like it a lot. Happiness to me seems to be more circumstantial, that it has to do with the circumstances in which we're living. And so as Peter would talk about, well, you want this new car, or you want to get, you want to get wealth or whatever it is, as if that's going to make you happy. Well, I do think money can buy happiness, at least for a short period of time.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be able to buy joy. And I would like to hear Peter talk about joy a little bit, the differentiation between those two. But I think the joy is actually where you recognize that you no longer have any power or control, and that everything that you have is truly the result of God.
Yeah, that's good.
Go ahead.
Good. No. I was saying
I started to use the word blessing, but I know we're going to talk about Dana in a few minutes, so I held off on that.
Okay, well, before we transition to Jamie, we'll talk about hashtag blessed. I think we've talked enough about Pete. I think we've talked enough about AJ already. Did you have anything else you want to talk about with AJ before we transition?
Well, first of all, I like the fact that he could stand up against you.
What? What are you talking against me?
Oh, man, he could handle your sarcasm really well. Hung in there. He's got a great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I like about him is he's read the book of Job many times.
Well, yes, that's obviously one of your favorites.
Okay. Another thing, when he says that these seasons of suffering, that they generate the why question, I think he's right. I also see that as a developmental process. I think there's a time where, and I'm not saying it's associated with chronological age or it's associated with the number of trials you go through, but I think some trials you just accept it and you go, okay, but you ask other really important questions, and I think that they identify in some ways what you hold to be part of your confidence in your faith.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. The other thing, it was interesting, his view about hell, which seems to be a more Christian traditional perspective. And but anyway, no, I really like what he had to say.
Good. Yeah, I liked AJ. He was a fun guy to talk to, and I agree. He handled the sarcasm well, and he was good. He played well.
So you guys are best bros.
Yeah, we're bros now. I think that we've moved past that. Okay, so Jamie, the very worst missionary, right?
Yes.
So she was on, and we just touched.
So she is not related to
N.T. Wright.
N.T. Wright.
No, okay. I thought possibly. Obviously, the last name is spelled the same, but turns out not everyone with the last name Wright is related. So she has her bit about hashtag blessed, which is clearly overdone. But what do you think a way to articulate that same sort of like gratitude to the man upstairs? What is the way to do that without having to give in to this understanding that every time something materially or on a more shallow kind of like American dream status goes your way, that it's a divine gift from God instead of maybe the more rich biblical understanding of what blessing is? Is there a way to kind of express that gratitude without kind of devolving into that?
I don't know that I've got a simple statement about that. I do think that I would rather see God as the giver of all good and perfect gifts. The problem is that I don't always know what a good or perfect gift looks like.
Yeah.
If it's money, that sometimes is a temptation to people that they really are underprepared to deal with. And I would not say God tempts us, But on the other hand, superficially, we might say, well, aren't they blessed because they got a lot of money? When in reality, that may not be a blessing at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We definitely live in a country that has some consequences from living in a society that has many things that are really, really good about it. And consequently, we're able to prosper. And some of those things may not really be part of God's agenda. It may not be that he is as much concerned about some of, quote unquote, our happiness, these circumstances, as he is about us being transformed into his likeness.
Yeah.
So I would say that ultimately a blessing is something that we recognize that is from God and that he is transforming us into his likeness. What that looks like in the flesh, I'm not sure I can always tell. And even afterwards, I think I'm better able to tell, but even sometimes afterwards, I'm not sure I know.
Yeah. There has to be a way to express gratitude and live from a sense of gratitude. I think that's one of the most essential things for anyone's well-being. But the word blessed seems to be like a godded-up attempt to do that, but it falls short because, like you're saying, it's not playing with God's language. It's not playing with God's parameters for what is a win and a loss. And if you use the Sermon on the Mount as a way to understand what it means to be blessed, it's diametrically opposed to what we often use when we say blessed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to me, it's just, it's become so popularized that it really is being defined, at least by the American culture. That's really what I know more about.
Yeah.
It's being defined a certain way by the American culture, which is not necessarily a biblical understanding at all.
No, no.
So I can appreciate Jamie pushing against that and saying, hey, a little more deliberate about this. Be more thoughtful about this.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really appreciate about Jamie was her willingness to be honest about her struggle with depression. And what I find really encouraging about that is she is setting a precedence for others that we can all come out and say, hey, I'm not perfect. This is what I struggle with. You know, these are the things that I have to wrestle with. And I'm interested in your take as someone who is dealing with people who struggle with depression on a professional level, how that came across to you and what your thought process is on how that can be an encouragement or beneficial for people who struggle with depression.
Well, I reacted a couple of different ways. One is I kind of heard her trying to shake off the stigma of depression, that we have a category, or now we refer to them in the DSM as a spectrum of disorders. And the whole idea of having psychological problems has a certain value within the culture. And I think what she's doing is trying to help shake off some of that stigma. And I think that's great.
Yeah.
For her to say, you know, she's listening to this person who is saying that her son or whatever is like a dog going back to his vomit, and that he ought to just stop doing it. It's like, oh my goodness, you're just really not understanding your son. You don't understand how painful that is.
What do you think that does to someone's son, or someone when they are someone's son who thinks that, when they hear their mom say that kind of comment? What does it do for someone?
Well, it depends on their relationship. You know, we all kind of allow a person to have influence over us. So, but a mother, just by the potential of having so much effect, I think it could be very damaging. I mean, you're talking really depression is really a spectrum of disorders that has things like sadness and emptiness associated with it, and hopelessness and helplessness, those kind of things. And as a result, that just kind of reinforces that kind of belief.
Yeah,
it compounds that whole thing. So, no, I think that is, to me, that's no different than saying to somebody who has, and I'm just going to pick out an arbitrary disease, so please don't take this out of context, but polio. and saying to the person, well, stop limping. You shouldn't limp. Just start walking. If you just tried a little harder,
yeah,
you can like everybody else.
But what seems to be behind that is the assumption that someone who struggles with a mental health disorder doesn't have the same sort of quote-unquote actual disorder as someone with a medical illness with a polio or something like that. Isn't that what he thinks behind it?
Yeah, and that's a false belief.
Yeah.
That's a belief that needs to be dispelled. So kudos to Jamie. Keep up. Stand up for other people that are struggling.
That's good.
Some of that belief goes way back before we understood anything about the neurochemical factors that are associated with the causes and maintenance of depression.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that maybe not gave me full-out depression, but really made me sad for a few minutes when I found out about it, was that Richard Beck cut his hair.
Well, now that's something to be sad about.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
So when he came into the office after cutting his hair over the holiday break or whenever it was, it took you a minute to process it, didn't it?
It did. It was quite a change. And, you know, I try to be very sophisticated, which if you look that up, it basically means artificial,
yeah,
by the way.
You're sitting in your office and you look out the window and Richard Beck flies by on his bike. It's sad not to see that hair of his just flowing in the wind.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
much of his being an independent thinker, of him not conforming to just the common wisdom of the day. And the good news is, whether he has long hair or short hair, he's still Richard Beck.
Yeah, that's good. That's a nice thing to say. That's nice. So did you listen to the podcast that we did?
Oh, absolutely. A couple of times. And
good.
I got to see him today in the office and say hi to him. He's been gone for a couple of weeks. He is he's one of my favorite.
Any subject matter that stood out from that podcast?
Yeah, I mean, and you kind of touched on it earlier, that number one, he's not just talking about Christianity, he's doing it.
Yeah.
When he talks to you about singing is one of his, if you will, spiritual disciplines that helps him to have gratitude, he's not telling you just intellectually, yeah, I think I ought to be singing, or I think other people ought to sing. He's telling you he's ministering to prisoners, and this is something that has come out of it.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's not just talking it, he's doing it. And that's Richard Beck. So, again, that's why he's one of my favorites. But the issue, more so about gratitude, I agree, but that's kind of one of the pillars of good mental health, positive psychology. It is one of the enduring qualities. And I do think it's a decision that we have to make. It's something that we have to work on. And sometimes through suffering, once we start to recognize literally every breath we take, our very life is a gift, it makes it easier to have a sense of gratitude.
When you say it's a decision, what does that mean to make the decision to be grateful?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to be aware of it. When a child is growing up, do they really know how much their parents are trying to do to help them? Are they grateful?
Yeah.
And the answer is, oftentimes, the answer is no. But now that you have three daughters and you know some of the things that are involved in raising a child, you become aware of what a gift you've been given. And now the decision comes in. Are you going to nurture this and develop it and look for other ways in which you can be grateful? Or are you just going to be egocentric and just go, well, I'm so great, everybody should be doing this for me.
Hmm. Okay, but when you're in the process, you're a parent, you don't have a person who is reciprocating all the effort you're pouring into them, they're not expressing gratitude. Is there something that helps you choose to be grateful in that moment?
Are we talking from the parent's perspective?
Well, obviously a five-year-old's not going to be listening to podcasts.
Right, right.
So
yeah,
I would assume that, yeah, like
from the, we're talking about,
yeah, yeah, for the parents.
Well, yeah, I think it's just like James would say about trials. If we're talking about the trial as a broken leg, I'm not going to look at the broken leg and go, woohoo, this is great. I've always wanted this. We're not going to look at having to get up in the middle of the night, night after night, and change diapers and feed an infant, those kind of things. On the other hand, we can look at it as what it produces within us. And, boy, if somebody wants a cure for being self-absorbed, at least they have the potential of getting beyond that if they raise a child. And they should get beyond it if they're raising a child. So they can be grateful for the maturity, for the patience, for challenging their narcissistic tendencies and their egocentric characteristics and develop.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that I think helps people choose gratitude is to be environments that are conducive for that. When I did the podcast with Zach Lynn, he talked about the importance of going to church, which I thought was like a very well articulated point that he made. He's articulating like the reason you go to church is not because you necessarily need to learn new things or come up with new ideas, but to be reminded of what you already know and to have songs that influence what you're thinking, because these are things that you should be reminded of. And that's definitely one of the things you have to be reminded of, is remind yourself of how grateful you should be.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah, I really loved his stuff on church. I thought it was just really good, the stuff that Zach did on that.
Well, I'm glad that there's, that many people look up to him, I assume. I didn't know much about him before this. I do want you to know I Googled him.
Did you listen to any Jimmy Eat World?
I listened to three of their songs.
Really?
Alternative rock. I don't have any training to know how quite to appreciate it, but I imagine that they are very accomplished musicians just based on what I heard.
Yeah,
to have somebody like that who's up front and influencing a lot of people and to be talking about the importance of church, I really think that's critical.
I'm a pastor. I like people saying church is important and the Bible is a good thing to read. So, yeah, I'm completely behind that.
Yeah.
Okay, any other highlights you definitely want to touch on from this last one?
Well, I thought Zach did a good job about talking about the idea of just being comfortable with failure, that we do learn through failure, and that for him to not allow the fear of failure to keep him from being creative, I think that's a life lesson that it's so easy for us to get to the point that we experience and, if you will, focus maybe more on our failures. And as a result, we become more and more conservative. We become more and more restricted in the way that we live. And I think that can really take the life out of who we are. So, and in fact, I think if I've got it right, to not be fearful is probably the one command or the one issue that's talked about the most throughout the Old and the New Testament combined.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, Dad, thank you for taking the time to come on the podcast. Thanks for helping me do the February wrap-up. It was a lot of fun.
Well, again, I just want to encourage everybody. They need to keep listening and tell their friends about this because I think you've really stumbled onto something that is powerful. And just to think that some of the most important ideas that are current, that are relevant to our culture, are really coming out on this podcast, and that encourages us to put this in the context of Jesus Christ. I think that's fantastic.
Well, thank you, Dad. Thank you, Dad. And this upcoming month, we've got a lot of good ones on. We've got just booked John Ortberg today. We've got Brian Zahn. We've got my friend Josh Patrick, which I was telling you about earlier. We've got Richard Rohr. So it should be a good month, that there should be some really good conversations. So look forward to those. And Dad, thanks again.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.